There's a British writer. His name is Ben Sixsmith. And he once observed something he called the twist of Christianity trend. And it said, if you take mainstream culture and beliefs and commitments and just add a twist of Christian faith on top of that, you will look just like everybody else. And then he wrote something that should make us uncomfortable. He said, if someone has a faith worth following, I feel that their beliefs should make me feel uncomfortable for not doing so. If they share 90% of my lifestyle and values, then there's nothing especially inspiring about them. Instead of making me want to become more like them, it looks very much as if they want to become more like me. It reminds me of a story about a man whose wife had been praying for years that he would come to church with her. Praying for years, asking him for years. She had the church praying for this man to come. And one day, he finally said yes. And he walked in a little uncomfortable, already feeling like he didn't belong, already feeling like everyone else probably knew what they were doing, and he didn't. And halfway through the sermon, the worst possible thing happened. His phone rang. Not a quiet buzz, not a gentle vibration, a full volume, unmistakable ringtone echoing through the sanctuary. He fumbles for it. His face turns red. He's turned off as fast as he can, and you could feel the eyes on him. You could feel the tension in the room. And after service, a church member came up to him and said, hey, you need to get your phone under control before next week. As I was walking out, the pastor passed by him and said, really, man? In the middle of my sermon. On his drive home, his wife said that she was embarrassed by the situation. He'd finally come to church, and all he felt was shame. Later that week, he went to a restaurant for lunch, and when he was reaching for his drink, he knocked over a glass, and it shattered on the floor. It was loud. Everybody heard it. He immediately stood up. He started apologizing. I'm so sorry. I'll clean it up. And the server rushed over and said, no problem at all. Accidents happen. And when he sits back down, a busboy finally got there with a broom and a dustpan, and he tried to take it from there. Here, let me clean up my own mess. I made the mess. I'll clean it up. And the busboy smiles and says, no worries. I got this. Happens all the time. The manager came by later to check on the table, and the man starts apologizing again. And the manager says, hey, you're fine. We're fine. Mistakes happen. We're just glad you're okay. And the man thought to himself, I felt more grace in that restaurant than I did at church. And that should bother us. That should bother us. Because the church is supposed to be the one place on earth where grace is not rare. The church is supposed to be the one place where people expect patience and kindness and understanding. It's supposed to be the one place where accidents, immaturity, awkwardness, even sin are first met with gentleness, not embarrassment. And yet sometimes the world does this far better than we do, which is exactly what Ben Sixsmith was getting at. If our conflict, our correction, and our response to people looks exactly like everyone else's with just a thin twist of Jesus on top, you're not living in a different kingdom at all. And that's a piercing observation. And it sets up our question perfectly in this Which Kingdom series. Because when it comes to conflict and relationships and sin inside the church, do we look any different from the world Or have we just added a twist to Jesus on the top and used the exact same patterns as everybody else? Last week in the verses right before this, we saw the kind of heart that belongs to Jesus' kingdom. The heart of a child, humble, dependent, aware of need. A heart that reflects a father who goes after the wandering sheep. This week we're looking at Matthew 18 that you just heard. And he talks about how that heart behaves when sin threatens the family. And what he describes here may be one of the clearest dividing lines between the two kingdoms. Because when relationships fracture and sin disrupts community, the two kingdoms respond in completely different ways. When someone sins against us, when there is hurt, when there is offense, when there's tension, when there's misunderstanding, when there's real wrongdoing, the kingdom of the world has a very predictable playbook. It says, avoid it. Talk about it with everybody else but the person you got a problem with. Build a case in your mind. Withdraw relationally. Let bitterness simmer and explode publicly when you just can't take anymore. We ghost people. We vent to other people. We post vague things online. We form quiet factions. We protect our pride. And sadly, churches look just like that. But Jesus describes something different, something that feels uncomfortable and awkward and vulnerable and deeply loving. The kingdom of God says, engage. Engage. Go to them alone, in love, for restoration. And that's weird in the world's culture, and it's a beautiful thing in the kingdom of God. In this story, Jesus is assuming something that we often want to dismiss. A reality that is difficult for us to really be okay with. I'm still going to tell it to you. It's between you and God and how you handle it. Okay? Here it is. Sin will happen in the church. Sin will happen in the church. You will be sinned against. You will sin against others. And Jesus doesn't tell us how to avoid conflict. He tells us how to redeem conflict. And in the kingdom of God, conflict's not an opportunity for division. It's an opportunity for restoration. Restoration. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault. Between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you've gained your brother. This is where the two kingdoms split immediately. The world talks about people. The kingdom of heaven talks to people. The world gossips and the kingdom of God pursues. The world protects pride. The kingdom risks humility. The kingdom of God, you go not to win, not to accuse, not to unload your emotions so you feel better. You go to gain your family member back. That is the goal. Not being right, but restoration. A guy once told a story about a neighbor he had. He had lived next to this guy for 5 years. They weren't enemies. They weren't friends. They lived in that suburban middle area where you wave at each other when you happen to be taking the trash out at the same time. You pretend you both care about the weather long enough to not feel rude, and you walk back to your own house. But one day he noticed that his neighbor stopped waving. Not dramatically, just no wave. And it bothered him. And he started thinking about it. Did I do something? And then he remembered a week earlier, his dog had gotten loose and used the neighbor's garden as a personal restroom. And he cleaned it up, mostly, probably. But now every time they see each other, it gets even more awkward. And the neighbor looked slightly annoyed at him, and he felt slightly guilty. But neither one of them said anything. Weeks went by, and then months went by, and the tension grew in his own head. And finally, one Saturday, he couldn't take it anymore, and he walked over and he said, "Hey, this is going to sound weird, but are we okay? I feel like my dog ruined our relationship." And the guy stared at him for a second, and he burst out laughing. And he said, "I thought you were mad at me because my lawn guy blew leaves into your yard." And they stood there for 10 minutes laughing about how a silent feud that never actually existed. One awkward, honest conversation fixed months of quiet distance. And they both realized how easy it is for relationships to drift, not because of big fights, but because no one wants to have a slightly uncomfortable talk that brings healing. Jesus keeps going. "But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses." If they don't listen, Jesus says, "All right, take one or two along with you." Not to gang up, not to build a case, but to help restore. The circle is still small. It is still careful. It is still loving. It is still hopeful because the goal has not changed. It's not about being right. It's not about getting closure. Interaction Jesus is talking about here is about one thing only. I keep saying it, you gotta know it by now. Restoration. Restoration. He is widening the circle of love. More voices calling someone back from danger. This is not about shame, this is about rescue. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. At a church I worked at before, one of the elders who was also the treasurer was an IRS agent. And I threw this verse at him quite frequently. It was all in fun, but what does this really mean? See, we've historically treated this verse, this passage, as an excuse to call out sin, call out every sin, and point fingers and tell people with a noticeable sin that they're excommunicated from the congregation until they fix their sin. That is not the goal here. The goal is restoration. And Jesus is saying, treat them as someone outside the people of God. If a person refuses to listen to a brother, and then a small group, and then the whole church, the issue is no longer simply about a simple sin. It's about rebellion. And even here, the goal is still restoration. We treat them like unbelievers. And how do we treat unbelievers? With gospel pursuit. If church discipline were all about sin, none of us would be here. Sin is not the issue. This is about a hard heart that refuses to listen, refuses help, refuses humility, refuses family. And the kingdom of God says, "We love you too much to let you wander off quietly." Remember, right before this, Jesus told the parable of the shepherd who leaves the 99 to go after the one. This passage is how the 99 join the shepherd. We become instruments of the Father's pursuing love. And this is where an old voice from church history helps. Augustine once wrote, "Our hearts are restless until they rest in you." He's talking about our relationship with God, but the same restlessness shows up in our relationship with each other. We drift, we wander, we become isolated, and God's design for restlessness is not independence, but a community that lovingly pulls us back when we stray. Augustine's got a more famous quote. You've probably heard, the church is a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints. And that's exactly what Jesus is describing here. A place where sick people are loved enough to be treated, not ignored. A place where wounds are bound and dealt with rather than covered up. And then Jesus says something in verses 18 to 20 that is often quoted completely out of context. Truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you, if two of you agree on earth about anything they ask, it'll be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among them. Could you even tell me how many times you've heard that last part quoted in a church setting? This is not Jesus saying that anywhere two Christians meet, that's church. That is not what this is saying. This is echoing what he said in Matthew 16. Jesus is saying when the church is working to rescue one of its own, heaven has your back. The Lord is especially present when his people are trying to rescue a wandering sheep. Jesus is saying when you do this hard and loving work of restoration, I'm with you. And my authority and my power and my presence are all behind you. We stand behind you. The concept of church discipline is difficult for some people. Josh Lehman wrote a book on church discipline. He talked about church discipline and accountability like this. If I'm a Christian at a coffee shop and I see two Christians in the coffee shop, one of them doesn't go to my church, still a Christian. That's okay. Let's clear that up. The other one does go to my church. The one that does not go to my church, I am happy to help in whatever faith issues he needs. I am happy to talk with him and help him out. But my obligation and my responsibility to the person in that's a fellow believer in my church is different. See, members of the church body, the members of the same church body, they say, we recognize that your profession of faith, your baptism and discipleship as Christ is valid. And we publicly affirm and acknowledge you belonging to Christ and the oversight of our fellowship. And then the individual, the member, acknowledges something similar. They say, insofar as I recognize you as a faithful God declaring church, I submit my presence and discipleship to your love and oversight. See, this passage only makes sense in the context of committed church life. You can't live this out in loose, unattached Christianity. Who's got permission to come after you when you drift? Who are you committed to go after? Membership is not paperwork. It is a safety net. You're saying, if I wander, come get me. And I'm saying that if you wander, I'll come get you. The world stays independent. The kingdom of God stays accountable. And that's why this teaching feels so strange. The kingdom of the world defines love as letting people do whatever they want. The kingdom of God defines love as caring enough to step in, When avoidance feels easier, when gossip feels safer, when silence feels more polite, but none of those are loving. In the early 2000s, there was a flight from Northwest Airlines that was cruising at altitude when something strange happened in the cabin. One of the flight attendants noticed a passenger who looked pale, looked disoriented. He was sweating heavily, but he kept insisting that he was fine, but she had this feeling that he wasn't. She could have moved on. The cabin was full. There were drinks to serve. And he kept saying he was okay. He was waving her off, but she stayed. She knelt beside his seat. She asked him some questions. She alerted the crew, and they made the decision to divert the plane and land early. Some passengers were frustrated. It was inconvenient. It disrupted schedules, all because of one man who kept saying, "I'm okay." When they landed, paramedics rushed on board, and the man was having a massive heart attack and had no clue. Doctors said later, if the plane had stayed in the air much longer, he never would have survived. Afterwards, the man told the crew something that stuck with them. He said, "I was annoyed with her. I didn't want the attention. I didn't think it was a big deal. And she saw what I couldn't see." And that's what loving confirmation often, confrontation often feels like. Unnecessary, uncomfortable, maybe intrusive. And most of you, when I told that story, identified with the flight attendant. Sometimes the person who slows you down, who asks the hard questions, who refuses to move, is the very person God is using to keep you from drifting into something more dangerous than you realize. Most of you have read these verses before and said, "Yeah, now I have biblical grounds to call somebody out." I want to ask you the real question here. I asked it earlier, but I got to do it again because you might have missed it. Who has permission to come after you when you drift away? Who has permission to come after you when you start to drift away? Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Augustine said the same thing a different way. Better to be corrected by a friend than flattered by an enemy. That's the culture Jesus is creating here. A community where correction is a form of love, not an act of hostility. So this is the great contrast between the two kingdoms. The world avoids conflict, but the kingdom redeems conflict. The world talks about people. The kingdom of God talks to people. The world protects pride. The kingdom pursues humility. The world values independence. The kingdom values accountability. The world cancels people, and the kingdom restores people. The world lets people drift, and the kingdom goes after them. Kingdom people do not let each other disappear quietly because we know how much we needed someone to come after us. So I want you to consider how you handle conflict within our church body here. Do you avoid or gossip or withdraw? Or do you pursue honesty and restoration? And I want you to ask yourself a more uncomfortable question. Who has permission to come after you on a personal level, what person in the church has permission to come after you? This whole series is about this. Pick a kingdom. Pick a kingdom. Which kingdom are you going to choose? In the kingdom of God, accountability, community, that's not optional. It's protection, it's grace, it's love in action. Jesus commanded us to lovingly pursue our brothers and sisters in the same way that he did us. As we come to the end of this passage, the question, the end of this section, the question is not, did you learn all the steps for church discipline? That is not what this is. The question is, do we have a heart for real church discipline? Because this Matthew 18 passage, this is not a technique for dealing with difficult people. It is a window into how the kingdom of God treats sinners. Before this passage is ever about how we go after someone else, it is about how Jesus came for us. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. This is the heart behind every step of this passage. Pursue, go, speak, listen, restore. And that's not church policy, people. That is the gospel. Because every single of us was wandering at one time. Every single one of us was the one who sinned. Every single one of us was the someone who needed somebody to come after us, not to shame us, not to embarrass us, not to push us away, but to lovingly move toward us. So hear me out. Communion. We're going to do communion here in a second, but communion is not a quiet religious moment. It is a reminder that the king of this kingdom that we are wanting to be a part of, the king of this kingdom, used his body and his blood to bring wanderers home. Before we ever go practice Matthew 18 on somebody else, you got to remember what Jesus practiced on you and what he practiced on us. He pursued us. He covered our shame. He absorbed our sin. He restored our place at the table, and he's inviting us to that table again. So as you take the bread and the cup today, don't just remember that you were forgiven, that you are forgiven. Remember how you were forgiven. With patience, with gentleness, with pursuit, and with grace. I want you to ask him to make our church a place where people experience the same grace from us that we've received from him. A place where the kingdom of God actually feels different than the kingdom of the world. A place where wanderers are pursued, a place where sinners are restored, and a place where grace is not rare.